From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will start by looking at the state of the healthcare system in Gaza, which is reaching almost complete collapse because of the continuous deliberate attacks on hospitals and healthcare workers. Then we will focus on the education system that is facing the same predicament also because of the deliberate attacks against universities and schools. After, we will see the role of journalists in Gaza and what does it mean to be a journalist during genocide. Finally, we look into the role of movies and cinema in keeping the Palestinian perspective alive and show what Palestinians are going through to the world. Stay tuned.
As we turn now to Gaza, where Israeli forces are continuing their unrelenting attacks, killing scores of Palestinians, even as Israeli and Hamas officials resume talks in Qatar aimed at a ceasefire. Al Jazeera reports Israel carried out over 100 bombings over the weekend. According to Gaza's health ministry, 31 Palestinians were killed in the last 24 hours. The UN is warning its efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip are at a breaking point after Israeli forces opened fire on a World Food Program convoy over the weekend. Staffers documented at least 16 bullet holes in their aid convoy's three vehicles, saying the shooting left them terrified. More than 330 aid workers in Gaza have been killed since October 7, 2023, according to the United Nations. Overnight on Monday, Dr. Tabat Salim, a Palestinian neonatal doctor and volunteer at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Nusayrat refugee camp. More than 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed in Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Dr. Salim's killing follows the destruction of the Kamel Adwan Hospital, the last remaining hospital in northern Gaza over the weekend. The head of the World Health Organization once again urged Israel to release Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, director of Kamel Adwan, from prison after he was arrested by Israeli forces along with other medical workers during a raid on December 27th. But Israel is not confirming that they have Dr. Safia. For more on the deteriorating situation in Gaza, we're joined in Syracuse, New York, by the acclaimed Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha. His recent piece for The New Yorker magazine is headlined Requiem for a Refugee Camp, which focuses on Gaza's largest refugee camp, now in ruins, Jabalia. It's where his grandparents grew up. Masab Abu Toha, joining us from Syracuse. Thank you so much for joining us again, Masab. If you can talk about Jabalia and all of this latest news we're getting out of Gaza. You know, we spoke to you in Gaza when you were there with your family. We spoke to you after Rafat Al-Arir, your colleague, a fellow poet, was killed in an Israeli airstrike, professor at Islamic University. We spoke to you in Cairo when you just gotten out with your family. We spoke to you in New York here in the studio when your book came out, Forest of Noise. And now we're talking to you today, this utterly painful piece, Requiem for a Refugee Camp, that you've just published in The New Yorker. Talk about your experience and what the centrality of this camp.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy, for the coverage. I mean, the painful thing is that we are talking about things today and next year would happen that we are talking about the same thing, the same losses, or even worse. So today is the anniversary of my friend Ma'ruf Al-Ashqar's killing. He was killed last year, and just 2 months ago, his father was killed in an airstrike. So today is his first anniversary. And we and the city Beit Lahia, which is next to Jabalia, the Jabalia refugee camp, is under the Israeli occupation. I mean, now when we're talking about the Israeli occupation, we are no longer talking about settlements in the West Bank or, you know, or Palestinian cities occupied by Israel in 1948. But now we can talk about the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, because not only did they expel people, and this is what I'm talking about in my piece about the refugee camp. Not only did they expel people, most people in the Jebel refugee camp have been expelled by the Israeli occupation. They not only expelled these people, but they also blew up the houses in the refugee camp where people used to live for 70 or more years. I mean, the house where my maternal grandparents were born, where they grew up, where they had my mother and her siblings, this house does not exist anymore. And this is really a very devastating thing for refugees. The refugee camp is a place that should have been a temporary place for people. They should be living in the refugee camp until they could return to the houses of their grandparents or their parents or even their own houses in Jaffa, in Haifa, etc. But these people were expelled from the refugee camp. The refugee camp is destroyed, and these people are now living in newly constructed refugee camps. And when we talk about refugee camps right now in Gaza, these are group of tents that do not protect people from the heat, do not protect people from the Israeli airstrikes. And we watched so many airstrikes that Israel carried out that were targeting tents, especially in the humanitarian zone. So the Jebel refugee camp is the largest of the 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. It was a home for about 120,000 people. All of them refugees from cities and villages close to the Gaza Strip. So it is a very devastating loss for people, not only to lose their friends, to lose their families, to lose their house, but also not to know whether they would be able to return to the refugee camp, which was supposed to be a temporary place. Just imagine, Amy, that you are expelled from your house in Jaffa in 1948, and then you live in a refugee camp, and then this same occupation comes and destroys the refugee camp. Now you are farther and farther from your dream of returning. Now you are dreaming of returning to the refugee camp. So this is really the tragedy of the Palestinian people right now.
This latest news that we have, we don't know where Dr. Abu Safia is. Many people know his name, head of Kamal Adwan Hospital, because he has been reporting on the conditions of the hospital. And now Israel is saying they don't have him. People are saying they saw him taken away. How is it that his lawyers cannot see him? You have the World Food Program, the UN organization, their convoy fired upon. Number of health medical personnel, from doctors to nurses to hospital staff, who've been killed in Gaza. Talk about the significance of this and what these hospitals meant for you when you lived in Gaza with your children and your wife.
So, Amy, really, really, something that really devastates my heart is that we are watching these things happening as we are talking. I mean, we have the news that Dr. Hotam Abu Safia was abducted from inside the hospital. We saw the hospital where he was working burnt and turned into ashes. And we saw the news about the Hind Rajab family and Hind Rajab herself. And we saw doctors and journalists being targeted and killed. So we have all this news, and nothing is changing the world in terms of taking action against Israel, punishing it. Not only, they did not get the Palestinians their rights, that are guaranteed by international law after 1948, but they are now watching a genocide being perpetrated by the same occupation, which was admitted to the United Nations just 1 year after it was established. Just imagine that it took Israel 1 year to become a member, a full member of the United Nations. And now it's been taking the whole world about 15 months, and we don't know for how many more. It's been taking them a long time even to stop Israel from perpetrating this well-documented genocide. And I would like, Amy, to draw your attention that 1 day after the Israeli army or the Israeli forces denied their position of Dr. Hassan Safia, 1 day later, the Israeli military spokesperson issued a statement that Dr. Hassan Abu Safia is with the Israeli army, and he is interrogated because he is suspected of being a Hamas member. So this was one thing that was issued 1 day after they denied they're having Dr. Hassan Safiya. So, I mean, this tells you that Israel, whenever they are under pressure, they will succumb. They will change their minds. They will say, oh, yeah, we have him and he's under interrogation. He's a suspected Hamas general. He's a Hamas general. He's not even Hamas. He's not only Hamas. He's a Hamas general. He's a very, very big guy in Hamas. You know, a doctor who is working with the patients, who refused to leave them, who was injured, whose son was killed. He could leave Gaza any day because he has a Kazakhstani citizenship. And I would like to draw your attention to another thing, which is that the director of Al Awda Hospital, Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, has been abducted by the Israeli forces from inside the Al Awda Hospital for 350 days. And there is no information about this doctor. I mean, the world started to pay attention and to advocate on behalf of Dr. Hassan Safiya because, you know, he had some reports, he had an Instagram page, he has been talking about the situation, so people knew him. So that's why people want him to be out. You know, because they feel like they knew him in person. But this Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, and this is the case of about hundreds of other people, these people, no one knows about them. You know, we haven't seen, I mean, I've never seen Dr. Ahmed Mhanna. I've never seen a video of him. But he's a doctor. He's the director of the Al Awda Hospital, and he's been abducted for about 350 days, about a year. And there is no news about him, and no one talks about him. And this is the case of so many people that we don't know about until they are dead, just like Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh. He was abducted from the same hospital, Al Awda Hospital. And the people paid attention to him when he died, and people, oh, yeah, yes. I mean, we don't want to die. We don't want to suffer for people or for governments to sympathize with us and say, oh, yes, we need him, bring him back. He is innocent. No, everyone in Gaza is innocent. Everyone in Gaza has been living this hell by Israel for decades, not for 15 months.
Musab Abu Toha, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Palestinian poet and author. We'll link to your piece in The New Yorker, Requiem for a Refugee Camp. He's the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. His latest book is called Forest of Noise. The Vote Sunday by the oldest learned association in the United States, the American Historical Association, which was founded by an act of Congress to approve a resolution to oppose scholasticide in Gaza.
Opposing the resolution, 88 votes. In favor of the resolution, 420.
Yeah! The results of that vote were read by the outgoing president of the American Historical Association, Duke University's historian Tavolia Glimpf. The vote was a vote of 428 in favor and 88 opposed. And the resolution was written by Historians for Peace and Democracy. There were four abstentions. This is one of the leaders of the movement talking about, right after the vote, her response.
We just won a very basic resolution to oppose scholasticide in 15 months of genocide at the American Historical Association. We won it in a landslide, and this moment makes me feel like, despite the fact that every single day for the last 15 months I have watched the obliteration of my people, the future is still ours.
Professor Shireen Sekhali, the American Historical Association's resolution to oppose scholasticide in Gaza reads, quote, whereas the U.S. government has underwritten the Israel Defense Forces IDF campaign in Gaza with over $12.5 billion in military aid between October 2023 and June 2024, whereas that campaign, beyond causing massive death and injury to Palestinian civilians and the collapse of basic life structures, has effectively obliterated Gaza's education system, Whereas in April 2024, UN experts expressed grave concern over the pattern of attacks on schools, universities, teachers and students in the Gaza Strip, including, quote, the killing of 261 teachers and 95 university professors, which may constitute an intentional effort to comprehensively destroy the Palestinian education system, an action known as scholasticide, unquote. That's the resolution to oppose scholasticide in Gaza, which was approved Sunday by the American Historical Association after speakers from both sides presented their arguments. The measure now will be examined by the AHA's elected council, where they can approve it, they can veto it, or decide to put the membership vote at the business meeting yesterday out to a full vote by the organization that has well over 10,000 members. For more, we're joined in Philadelphia by Shireen Saikali, an associate professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies and co-editor of Jedalia. Saikali is on the editorial board of the American Historical Review. She helped to lead the push for the vote. And joining me here in New York is Barbara Weinstein, a history professor at New York University. She served as president of the American Historical Association in 2007. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We just heard Professor Saikali responding at the Hilton at the moment of this overwhelming vote by the membership who attended the business meeting. Professor Weinstein, you were president of the American Historical Association in 2007. Can you talk about the significance of the AHA, what its role is in American society, its history, for taking this vote today, yesterday?
Well, the AHA is, again, the oldest continuing learned society in the U.S., and I think it's among the very few that were created by an act of Congress. So the AHA is kind of almost a gatekeeping organization for the history, and not just of the United States, but because it's not just historians of the U.S., it's historians of every place on the globe. And so, I think it has generally been a relatively moderate, sometimes even conservative organization. But I think over the years, it has become increasingly clear that we can't have a narrow definition of what our roles are as historians. And there's been more and more of a willingness to take a position on issues that relate directly to our roles as historians, as educators, as researchers, as archivists. And so this is really a significant indication of the organization's willingness to think about its role more capaciously.
And so if you can talk about the positions it's taken in the past, even as you were president in 2007.
So in 2007, I think that was the first moment when we were willing to do this, because I just to very quickly say there's a backstory to this, which is that during the Vietnam War, the AHA was very resistant to taking any kind of position on the war, insisting that it was not a political organization and therefore could not take a position. But by the time we're talking about the Iraq War, we could already see the implications that the war had for doing research, for traveling to conferences, that it was having an impact on the lives of scholars. And so the connection between what the association does and what was happening in the world was becoming clearer and clearer. And that resolution passed, the condemning the invasion of Iraq, fairly easily. So it indicated a real turn in the association's direction.
It was fascinating to see the four presidents, the president-elect in 2 years, the outgoing president, Tavolia Glimpf, the Duke University historian who read the results of this vote, and Ben Vinson, who's now the new president of the American Historical Association, who is the new president of Howard University.
Yes.
So, Shireen Saikali, you are one of the spearheads of this resolution that overwhelmingly passed. You are also editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies, not to mention a historian at UC Santa Barbara. Talk about the significance of this moment and why you chose to focus this resolution on scholasticide.
Thank you so much, Amy. And I really have to give credit where it's due, which is to the Historians for Peace and Democracy, which is a group that actually began in 2003 under the name of Historians Against the War. And they really, they were really the spearheads and leaders of this resolution. I think it's really significant. As a historian of Palestine, the American Historical Association last January, in the 3 months into the beginning of the genocide, did not have any panels on Palestine. And I remember very strongly feeling like I was in an alternate world with this huge conference, right? It's one of the largest academic associations that has, correct me if I'm wrong, Barbara, 11,000 members. And it was so shocking to be at a conference in the midst of this interminable grief, a conference of historians, and not have a single word being talked about directly centering Palestine and the Palestinians. And so this moment was one I never thought I would experience, in which we are really recognizing both the Israeli assault and destruction of the education system in the Gaza Strip since October 2023. Israel, armed, aided, and abetted by the United States, has destroyed 80% of the schools in the Gaza Strip and every single university. And another thing that I think is often put to the side or marginalized, and we really have to center as historians, is that almost every single archive, library, and bookstore have been bombed and destroyed by Israel. And so this genocide is really attempting to destroy our capacity to narrate our past and to imagine our future, and to be able to articulate a principled, but really not that radical, of a resolution opposing this with such a landslide of support was a turning point for the American Historical Association, and I believe for the field in this country.
I wanted to get your response to an opponent, Natalia Petruzzella. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, a New School professor, reading from Inside Higher Ed, who said the resolution doesn't mention October 7, 2023, Hamas attack on Israelis or hostages Hamas took. She said passing this resolution as the view of the AHA stands to hurt the historical profession and academia writ large. She said it would only lend credibility to accusations of political bias in academe, and, quote, these attacks will only intensify with the coming Trump administration. Professor Cycli, your response to that, and I'd also like to get yours as well, Professor Weinstein. Professor Cycli.
Thank you. So I would say first about the point, the both sidisms, right? And we got this from more than one of the opposing figures attempting to equate the last 15 months with the incidents of October 7. And to me, that is really a very clear position of valuing certain lives over others. And this is the kind of hiding of the truth that we have seen. We know that today in the Gaza Strip, when there are rumors of humanitarian convoys coming, Israeli soldiers bulldoze corpses to hide the evidence of decomposing bodies. And it isn't just these soldiers who are trying to hide the truth. This is also happening in mainstream media, in the courts, as well as in our universities. And I think this equating is really trying to mask that truth that can no longer hide under the rubble. For the second point, and here I'd like to quote our colleague Van Gogh, who really warned us about falling prey to anticipatory obedience. I was really surprised and taken aback that historians would suggest that the way to deal with the coming attacks and precarity that academics will continue to feel and might escalate under the Trump administration by being passive and silent and not taking a principled stance. scholars and students of history know much better than that. It is not, the way forward is not to be passive and obedient. The way forward is to be ethical and to stand for what is just and to stand against this Israeli genocide, which is, again, armed and abetted by the United States.
Professor Weinstein.
So just before I directly answer the questions, I just want to emphasize what Serene just said about the role of HPAD, Historians for Peace and Democracy, and particularly Van Goss and Margaret Power, who were the key movers. They're the co-chairs and the key movers in putting this resolution together. To start with the second point, I completely agree with everything both Van Gogh said at the meeting and that Serene just said, that the idea that we're going to self-censor because people for whom most historians have, you know, regard as in no way sort of qualified to comment on our scholarship, to evaluate our scholarship, who are now in power, that we're going to start censoring ourselves because of them, it is really absurd, especially since we're talking about people who are not going to be imprisoned and tortured as a result of saying things that the government doesn't like. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to be a little bit brave and say, you know, I'm not going to change the way I do history because Donald Trump is now president. So that whole argument about we have to be careful or we'll be targeted, it seems to me borders on the absurd. And as for the issue of October 7th, the historians understand that the immediate cause of something is not necessarily what helps us understand all of the processes involved. There, the October 7th may, you know, if I were doing a history of this war, obviously I would talk about October 7th. But if I'm talking about Scholasticide, the destruction of every university in Gaza, the importance of October 7th it exists in another realm of, you know, of explanation.
Well, Professor Cicely, as we begin to wrap up, the resolution ends this way. It says, finally, be it resolved that the AHA form a committee to assist in rebuilding Gaza's educational infrastructure. What would this look like?
I'm not sure. I think that what it looks like in the immediate is that we put our energy and our resources and our creativity as historians to follow the lead of scholars, Palestinian scholars in the Gaza Strip, as they continue their educational mission from tents and, you know, the collaborative collective of scholars from Palestinian scholars in the Gaza Strip have said to us, we started in these tents, we will continue in these tents. And I think I would end with learning from those Palestinians in the Gaza Strip would entail exactly as Barbara suggested, the lesson that history did not begin in October 7, and that this is a century-long struggle for Palestinian political rights and freedom.
In Gaza, Israeli strikes killed 28 Palestinians on New Year's Day, including women and children. Today, Israeli attacks killed at least 52 Palestinians since dawn, striking northern Gaza's Jabalia, the central Berej refugee camp, Gaza City, and a tent camp sheltering displaced families in Al-Mawasi in southern Khan Yunis, in an area designated as a so-called humanitarian zone.
When the morning came, we came to inspect the site, and as you can see, it is devastation, complete destruction. What have the children done to be hit at 1 a.m? There is no safe area at all. No safe area. Wherever you go, those by the sea have been hit, here has been hit, there were strikes further away, the strikes are everywhere.
This comes as a seventh infant in Gaza has died from hypothermia as displaced people in tents struggle to keep warm in the winter amidst days of heavy rain that flooded the camps. This comes as a UN Human Rights Office report released Tuesday documented how Israeli attacks on hospitals between October 2023 and June 2024 have pushed Gaza's healthcare system to the brink of collapse. This is Ayman Abu Hattab, a Palestinian father seeking medical attention for his son at a flooded field hospital in Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis.
I came to treat my son, but I found the hospitals in such a state, as you can see. This is a situation unfit for any hospital in the entire world. This is but the least of the problems for our children. We want the Arab countries to see what's happening to us for the sake of the hospitals, because everything is flooded.
New data shows the Gaza population has fallen 6% since the start of Israel's assault on Gaza more than a year ago. For more, we go to Deir al-Balah in Gaza to speak with Shu'ela, independent journalist and producer in Gaza. She was recently honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists, that's CPJ, in their 2024 International Press Freedom Awards. Her husband, the journalist Roshdi Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October 2023. He ran eMedia, which Shrut now heads. CPJ described Shrook's story as emblematic of the plight of journalists in Gaza, quote, who've endured the unthinkable and continue to report the news for the world to see. Just last Thursday, an Israeli strike killed five Palestinian journalists outside Al-Awda Hospital in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. One of those five journalists in their car that was clearly marked press was waiting for his first child to be born inside the hospital. Shrook, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for being with us. If you can describe the scene on the ground as we hear about another baby dying of hypothermia, the winter weather so dangerous for the people of Gaza because of the tents that they are living in, because of their completely devastated condition and the closing of so many hospitals because of airstrikes and raids.
Hey, Emmy, and it's so weird to say Happy New Year from genocide, but hopefully it will be end very soon. So on Tuesday, the rain, storms flooded and uprooted the displacement tents, the makeshift tents of displaced people, like worsening the already deteriorating living conditions of them. Over 2 million displaced people are facing life-threatening conditions because of the extreme cold and the heavy rain. In addition to that, it's important to mention that these tents cannot withstand the heat in summer, and nor can they stand the cold and rain in winter. Even though it's really important to mention that nowadays, like it's been like almost 3 months, the Gaza Strip has been suffering of suffocated siege by the Israeli army, and making more, you know, tightening the siege to prevent the entry of basic needs. Like, for example, there is a shortage of blankets, mistries, warm clothing, and very little wood for fires. And this, the current situation actually signals an immediate need for intervention. Otherwise, there will be a real humanitarian crisis that just ahead in the beginning of this winter.
Shru, first, it's horrifying to say, just as you said, it's hard to say Happy New Year as you describe the situation on the ground. But congratulations on winning the CPJ Award, the Committee to Protect Journalists, which has to be also extremely painful for you, as your husband, the journalist Roshdi Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike more than a year ago. And you have so many journalists, well over, what are the numbers, around 170, 80, perhaps more than 200 journalists and media workers killed in Gaza. Most recently, among those killed were the five together outside Al-Auda. And I was wondering if you knew any of them. But talk about the meaning of being recognized for your work.
Like, it's really, you know, I can say it has, you know, double faces in this. The first one, it's really, it acts me deeply to receive awards over the loss of my husband, you know, and you know, not coping, but I can say just, you know, being more resilient and standing in front of the camera or behind the camera and document the horrible situation here. And the good part is in this that people are hearing us. I thought for somehow that I lost hope in humanity, but this award actually brought me to the surface to remind me that what we are doing here under genocide is remarkable. People are hearing us, and you know, they feel us. And from here, I wanted to send my respect and appreciation for all of those who are supporting us and believing in the how exhausting we are. And I can say also, I want to say, I know it's a new year, and I just want to express how exhausted I am. It's not only me. I'm just, you know, I'm representing all of my fellow journalists here. It's been over 14 almost months of being under genocide, doing the coverage day after day, having inside that anxious, anger, fear, hunger, and, you know, the sense of insecurity above all of this, and also coping with the losing of dear ones, homes, works, and whatever. So I just want to say that we are exhausted, but knowing that people outside are, you know, are awarding us, it's such a relief for us.
Shru, can you describe to us what your day looks like? When you get up in the morning, how you do your work amidst the devastation?
All right, I can say it's such a long day. First of all, since you are not living alone. You are living with lots of family members and relatives because of that limited spaces that, you know, afforded for people, for displaced people. You know, there is plus 2 million Gazans are displaced now. So, like being in housing in a place with plus 18 person inside, it means that you wake up in the very early morning because of the chaos and noise around you, because of the kids, and also because of that, you know, the so-called safe areas are super crowded with people, so there is always noise to wake you up. And the so I woke up like in the very morning, sometimes at 5 or 6 a.m. And then I want to say that I try as much as I can to have my pure time and moments with my little daughter who got lost her father in the beginning of this genocide. And also because that feel that if I left home, I'm not sure if I'm coming back. So I try as much as I can to catch some moments with her before I leave. And once I leave, you know, there is a transportation crisis here because of the shortage of fuel. So we are using the traditional means of transportations, like that cart tracked by donkeys, for example. That you feel you will never arrive to your destination because it's very slow and because of the crowdness of the streets outside. But otherwise, the other alternatives are somehow quite expensive and not affordable. And I can say sometimes it takes me two to three hours to arrive to my destination to do the filming. And I have to mention that especially in Khan Yunis city, like the entire city is already, you know, flattened in the ground. Like according to the municipality of Khan Yunis, like 90% of the city destroyed, whether partially or completely destroyed, which means there is no streets. It's all about random shifts, random tents around everywhere. So like when it comes to filming in Khan Yunis, it means you have to waste your entire day in arriving to the area and leaving the area as well. And also because of the signal there is very weak because of, you know, not stopping attacking of the networks. Once I've done my filming, there is another problem, and I can say there is another hardship that we as journalists we are facing is the issue of the internet access. There is no internet access, a proper one as we used to have before this genocide. So I try to move to the area of the president, because this president provides you with electricity and a suitable internet to do your uploading. And I want to tell you, like, it's been plus 1 year of not lighting the light in the room because there is no electricity. I know that people outside cannot comprehend how does it mean to not have electricity, but it really happens this way. It's just the solar panel alternatives and batteries, which just function, for very few hours. And when it comes to winter, you can barely use it.
True. Is it possible for you to leave? And would you leave? Why do you stay there?
You have to know, when this genocide started, I've been abroad along with my daughter and husband. We were on a work trip outside Gaza. And when it started, we immediately canceled everything and returned to Gaza, because my husband and I, we are both journalists, and we believe in that. If you are a journalist, you are a journalist for life, and it is just a duty. You have to do it for your company, for your country, for your people, just to be on a duty during such timing. Yeah, I believe that nobody ever like imagined it would be as harsh as it is now, but I never regret this, because I believe that being here in Gaza means that I'm doing a change. Even this change is not pushing for a ceasefire, but at least people are getting more aware about our suffering and our cause here in the Gaza Strip. And there's also the other point of this, that it's been like almost 7 months of the closure of the Rafah crossing border, which is the only gate out of Gaza that is just connected by the Egyptian authorities. This gate is just closed. This border just closed once in May. Once the Israeli army launched the military ground operation in the Rafah crossing border and area as well, and causing the damage of this border. So I can say that we are all trapped here. No way out. Just the sky. You die and you fly to the sky. This is the only way out of Gaza nowadays.
We turn now to Gaza, where Israel continues to intensify its attacks, killing at least 35 Palestinians since dawn. Authorities report more than 70 killings over the last 24 hours, including in Al-Mawasi, a region that Israel designated a so-called humanitarian safe zone. As Israel's relentless war on Gaza enters its 15th month, we turn now to a film that's been shortlisted for this year's Oscars, From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made in Gaza by Palestinian filmmakers surviving Israel's bombings. This is the film's trailer.
Isn't this tragic?
As you can see, we're picking up flour and sand. That's all we have left to do. We pick up whatever we find on the ground. We have to eat.
22 extraordinary stories.
There are always drones making a buzzing sound. They are always above our heads when we sleep, study, dance.
From 22 Palestinian filmmakers.
Mom wrote on my arm, "If they bomb us and kill us, we'll be identified from our names written on our bodies."
Living through war.
I was targeted 3 times in 24 hours. The first time, my cousin and I were returning from Camp 5. They attacked the house and we were buried in the wreckage.
Musab, who's next to you? Khalid? Is he dead?
Yes.
Believe me, my friend, I had a beautiful life in a beautiful city.
We want to laugh, rejoice, sing and express our emotions. Yes, there are bombings and destruction and many other things that take us back to zero. But that only increases our challenge to overcome.
Today, I want to tell you a story. Are you ready?
Our greatest loss was not being able to see the film in front of the audience on the big screen.
No to injustice, no to violence, no to the violation of human rights. No to everything that goes against humanity, joy, life. No to everything that destroys our hopes.
That's the trailer for From Ground Zero, which has been shortlisted for the 2025 Oscars, along with two other Palestinian films, No Other Land and An Orange from Jaffa. The film is being released nationwide in the United States today. It made news recently when the acclaimed documentary filmmaker Michael Moore, Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, joined as executive producer. We go now to France, where we're joined by Rachid Masharawi, renowned Palestinian filmmaker originally from Gaza, who curated and directed From Ground Zero. This is an astounding collection, Rachid. I spent the night watching it and then watching it again. It is so deeply moving. Explain, not often do you see a director called the curator. Explain what you did.
Hi. Usually as a film director from Gaza, usually I am doing my own film. But this time for me, the situation was different. The images was different. The size of the massacre, the killing, we never witnessed something like this. So then I decided, okay, my coming film or my next film will be made by filmmakers from Gaza, just to give the chance to 22 filmmakers to tell their own stories, their own daily life, to get closer to the details, because I believe these people must share their own stories with the world. At the same time, you know, we are filmmakers. We are trying to make cinema, to deal with art, with culture, in spite of all what happened. We were trying to search for hope. Yes.
I want to go to another clip. We played the trailer, but this is a clip of the short film Sorry Cinema, featured in From Ground Zero, where the director Ahmed Hassouna is fleeing for his life after an Israeli strike near his home in Gaza.
Now my life has become a different kind of marathon. Now I am running to save my family's lives, my own life. I run, hoping to find food and drink for my children, who flee the bombings from one house to another.
Ahmad, are you okay? Where are you? Get out of there. Are you okay? Come.
I struggle to endure the things I see and hear. Everything that is happening to us, everything we are going through. I have just lost my older brother in a random bombing next to his house. What? The whole tower collapsed. At that moment, I felt death catching up with us. Our only chance of survival was luck. Our only chance of escaping the rubble, the bombing houses, the ruins of the city. Nowhere in Gaza is safe, especially in the north, where I currently live. Here, no humanitarian aid, nor rescue, nor civil protection arrives. All that comes are bombs, fear, stress, and insecurity.
Talk about Ahmed Hassouna's story, Rachid.
Yes, Ahmed, he was known in Gaza before the war. He's a cinephile. He's all his life spent after watching film, searching about films, trying to make films in Gaza, from Gaza. And all the time he was looking for an opportunity to make his new film. During the war, I contacted Ahmed and I told him, join me in my project From Ground Zero, be one of these filmmakers, this is your chance, because I'm going to show these films internationally and worldwide. And immediately he said, no, I don't want to make a film, Rashid. He said, I am trying to save my family. I am searching for wood to make a fire, to cook for the family. We are moving every day to from one place to another. And just a few days ago, I lost my older brother. So I don't want to make a film. Sorry for you. Sorry for the cinema, Rashid. And I was shocked from his answer because I know his love to cinema. And then 2-3 weeks later, I get back to him and I say, Ahmed, let's make what you told me in our conversation. Let's make a film about a filmmaker from Gaza. He have no time to make cinema because he's trying to save his life. Show us something from your previous films. Show us your daily life and show us how you are going to make it to say sorry for the cinema. And then we agree and we come with this film, the one that everybody watching now, Sorry Cinema. I think people must know, beside all these people whose martyrs we talk about, it's been more than 50,000 now. Most of them are innocent. Most of them are people who are really searching for life. People like Ahmed Hassouna, he want to be a filmmaker. And from ground zero, we have many people want to be a painter, want to be stand-up comedy. They want to be a dancer. I mean, people like any other people in the world trying to manage their own dreams. And I was interested in these people to tell the stories, the normal stories, the real life under all this massacre and the genocide.
You were born and raised in Gaza, Rashid Mashrawi. Through the making of this film, you also witnessed the destruction of your home, your reflections as you tried to encourage these filmmakers. They'd be in the middle of a film, they'd lose a family member, they'd lose many members of their family, talking to you about not being able to go on.
Yeah. Yes, it means for me, it was logical and normal that I will be involved in from ground zero as a Gazaian. All my family are in Gaza now. And as you say, we lost many people from my family and we lost our houses. I lost all the neighborhood where all my memory, my school, my childhood games, friends for sure, neighbors for sure, and many things. But still, you know, I'm someone known as I always optimistic. I'm always adding hope. I believe in cinema, in art. I trust cinema, you know, because I think cinema should play the role that it's playing in from ground zero. Cinema for justice, you know, cinema for humanity, cinema just to remind the world all the time, we are all humans. We are the same. We have the same dreams. Many people was killed because they were in Gaza at this location at this time. And they have nothing to do with what's going on. Women and kids and old people. Okay, we know what happened in 7 October. We know when Hamas get out and they attack and they hostage people and they kill people and they arrest people. Me, myself, I know also many, many massacres that the Israelis did before 7 October. This struggle, it started more than 77 years ago, before 1948. And we have, as Palestinians, we have to keep telling our stories. We have to fight to make good cinema also and to share all these stories with the world. I am very happy that these films are now crossing the U.S., showing in many cinemas. And I will be very happy when many people just go and watch, because it's not the news. It's not a reportage. It has something else. It has nothing to do with politics even. It has something to do with our world that we are all sharing. We are looking for justice.
Rashid Mashirawi, yes, the film is opening today in cinemas across the country. It's also gotten headlines because the award-winning filmmaker, Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, has joined you as executive producer. Now, he won the Palme d'Or for the documentary film Fahrenheit 9/11, becoming the first and only documentary to win there. Your film was accepted at Cannes, where he won the Palme d'Or, but then rejected? And what did you do?
I think our films were from the beginning rejected. I mean, we never was accepted in Cannes. We were in discussing with Cannes to try to show even not all from Ground Zero, some films from Ground Zero, because I was coming with to Cannes with films and filmmakers, you know? And I think they don't want to deal with us. Even they say it in the press conference of Cannes before the festival. They don't want to deal with the tension, with the political, with all what's happening in the area. It was only Gaza. It was only Palestine. I mean, I remember 2 years before when the president of Ukraine was having space in the opening of Cannes making speech.
Right, that was President Zelensky.
Yes, it was also to deal with the war and to deal with politics. You know, I feel sorry for Cannes Film Festival because I consider Cannes Film Festival, it's an important festival, good festival, big festival. It should make his job. It should play his role to give space, to give stage to filmmakers and to cinema and to protect humanity through cinema, through art, through filmmakers. And they didn't. I think they lost the opportunity to be. It means they were there and we were also there. So I say then, if Cannes don't want to go to Gaza, Gaza will go to Cannes. So I take my team, I build our tents in Cannes, like the tents in Rafah, exactly. We have our own screenings, our own sound, our own audience. And we make our own films. We make the people from Gaza to speak, the filmmakers, to speak inside Cannes with the audience. And we bring Gaza to Cannes during the festival. But officially, we were not in Cannes.
Rashid, we just have a minute. So to clarify, it wasn't originally accepted at Cannes, but it is premiering here in the United States across the country. You partnered with Watermelon Pictures, the first distribution company for Palestinian films in the U.S. We have 30 seconds. The significance of this collaboration.
I am really, really proud, you know, with what they are doing, Watermelon. I feel that I already won the Oscar because my aim is to show these films to maximum people. And this is what Watermelon is doing. They are showing these films everywhere. And also the input, what Michael Moore bring to this these films, it's really to join us and to share the stories with many, many, many people. I just can appreciate and thank with all, from all my heart for all these people who participate and help and support from Ground Zero.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we looked at the state of the healthcare system and the education system in Gaza, both nearing complete collapse because of the deliberate attacks against them by the apartheid state. Then we saw what does it mean to be a journalist during genocide. And finally, we looked at the role of cinema to show what Palestinians are going through. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find it. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
are listening to the only destination for local music, sports, and news, CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
When I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying yes to every beat. Yes, 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 this rocks. And then sometimes I switch it up like,
no! No!
Don't stop a rockin'!
Every Friday morning, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m.